Case number 24-3005, United States of America, appellant versus Roberto Adams. Mr. Hobel for the appellant, Mr. Kramer for the appellee.
Morning.
Good morning, your honors. May it please the court, Mark Hobel for the United States. I'd ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Defendant Roberto Adams failed to carry his burden on plain error review to show that the inadvertent omission of the Carter prophylactic instruction actually prejudiced him and affected his substantial rights. The district court erred in concluding otherwise. Based on...
It doesn't matter that it was inadvertent, does it?
On plain error? No, but it was inadvertent. But the district court, in order to correct that error, watered down the plain error prejudice standard and relied on the speculative possibility that the jury might have held the defendant's silence against him.
How are they ever going to know, actually? I mean, everything has to be speculation. There's no way to know what the jury actually would have done. In any case, it involves either evidentiary information or evidentiary, correct?
Right. And on plain error review, that uncertainty weighs against the defendant.
You can never have plain error review when you have to just try to figure out how the jury would have resolved something in a counterfactual world?
Certainly not.
We've acknowledged that, in fact, this prong requires some speculation. You aren't going to have hard evidence as to what the jury was thinking and how it would have affected them.
Right. And the Nwoye case, and I may mispronounce that, but the Nwoye case in which this court has acknowledged that the reasonable property inquiry is inherently speculative, I believe that's the language that Adams quoted, that case involved a much firmer factual foundation than the court had here. In that case, the defense attorney essentially threw away the only possible duress defense to conviction there by failing to call an expert. That was an ineffective assistance case. But the court at least had something to point to rather than the sort of inherently speculative.
You didn't just go, well, I don't know what happened. Maybe they could have. The district court went through a lot of concrete things about this case, a lot of concrete factual information, a lot of observations that he had a front row seat to. He didn't just sort of say, well, maybe. I mean, I don't understand the speculation argument. We've acknowledged that we don't know. We're looking into a black hole here. And so we look at the whole of the district court's opinion, which is very specific and very concrete about the concerns about, you know, the weaknesses in the evidence or what a close call it could have been on the knowledge question, had a reason for why this could have impacted the deliberations on the second two counts, given the nature of the end, given the closeness of the evidence. And so that's not raw speculation. That seems to be exactly the type of analysis that we've said it's just the nature of the beast in this area.
Well, the fact that the district court cited to the record does not insulate its reasoning error.
I didn't say just because he cited to the record. There were specific reasoning given here.
Right.
And it seemed like if we assume it's reasonable, if we conclude that it's reasonable, that it reflects the expert view that the district court judge had, and that the analysis of how in this case with its, you know, twists and turns and the different nature of the first and second applications could have made the differentiation, followed up exactly on the differentiation the jury made.
Right.
In that context.
Right. And what we submit is the possibility that it could have made a difference under the Supreme Court's holding in the United States v. Marcus. A possibility of prejudice is not enough for a defendant to carry his burden on plain error review. That's the fundamental distinction between plain error and harmless error. And as we pointed out in our brief, the district court here applied a standard that was substantially more equivalent to
substantial probability of an effect on the jury verdict. That's prejudice. That's our words. That's the rules.
Right. And I again point the court to the actual reasoning at page 29 of the transcript of its oral ruling, where it stated a reasonable jury could have acquitted the defendant. It may have wondered. A reasonable jury might have wanted to hear from the defendant.
But that's the kind of speculation we said is just going to have to happen. Right. That's he can't say. Are you complaining the district court didn't say the jury would have or did? Is that the objection?
I think that it relied on a residual possibility of prejudice and disregarded what it acknowledged was damning evidence on the count of conviction. Even it acknowledged damning evidence.
It was a split verdict.
It was a split verdict.
And doesn't that tell you something about what you could read into that as well?
In this case, it does. And the district court discounted that because it found that it was not unassailable evidence. But here, the split verdict shows
that the evidence was circumstantial. Now, I know that in a jury charge, you would look to evidence as direct and circumstantial, weighing evenly, that they could account for both. But still, you know, when you look at circumstantial evidence plus a split verdict, how does that affect your decision?
It's
or argument.
Right. It weighs in our favor. And here's why. The split verdict is itself evidence that the jury considered the actual evidence in the case and drew a distinction between the two counts. The evidence on count two was absolutely stronger than the evidence on count one where the jury acquitted. The second loan fraud was the second time that Adams pulled the same fraud on the government. By that time, he had already spent the first loan proceeds on gambling, on vacations, not on paychecks for his small business. He had already received multiple emails directly from his loan processor that set forth requirements for the second draw loan that he knew he could not meet.
He had the same problem that he didn't see the papers that were submitted to the government. He didn't sign the papers that were submitted to the government. And so, again, for knowledge, you had the same sort of trouble or difficulty that you had for the first count, but then you had this additional evidence. But that's when the district court reasoned that, as they said, why didn't he explain himself? That could have factored into his decision.
Right. And by the time of the second loan, there was just a lot more evidence such that even the government in rebuttal said to the jury, even if you don't think that you can't infer.
You recognize that your first count was weaker.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that your second and third counts were so strong that the district court abused its discretion in concluding that there was prejudice here and that the fourth prong, the integrity of the proceeding, were both implicated.
You
didn't have overwhelming evidence on the knowledge question. You just didn't have overwhelming evidence on the knowledge question. You know, doesn't matter what I would think one way or the other on a jury. District court trying to analyze it.
The district court found that we had damning evidence. I'm not sure what the distinction between damning and overwhelming is, but from the district court's perspective, because it effectively made the government disprove the possibility that the jury held the defendant's silence against him, even though there was no comment here by anybody in this case. Adams has pointed to no comment by anybody in this case that could even indirectly be seen as a comment on his silence. And that's, you know, United States.
The government, absolutely. That's to the credit of the prosecution, absolutely.
Right. But in United States v. Monahan, this court noted that this is the type of case where there's no comment that even by the wildest stretch of the imagination could be seen as commenting on the defendant's silence, where this type of prophylactic instruction is likely to do the least good for the defendant. So you have
damage. Split verdict case?
No, that was a case involving the Catala, a split verdict case, Small, a split verdict case. Both of those cases, this court found that the split verdict demonstrated a lack of prejudice.
But why would you say it would be the least likely to do any good for the defendant to offer this kind of instruction when that is an instruction that is always given? And the district court recognized their error in not giving it, particularly at the request of the defendant.
Right. It's not always given. It is at the request of the defendant. So it's not
generally given. I mean, as a trial judge, you're going to put that in your own set of instructions even before a defendant asks you. That's just one of the common instructions that would be part of any criminal process.
Well, no. As we said in our brief, there are many more recent cases after Carter that say reasonable minds can differ on whether this instruction actually does good for the defendant. It's a prophylactic instruction.
They were asking for it from the beginning, from time and time again. They didn't obviously object at the end, but they asked time and again, and there's no doubt, following Judge Child's question, that it has to be in your instructions.
Well, if I could, that's not exactly the case, Your Honor. So the initial request came in the joint pretrial statement before there was any indication, before the decision had been made that Adams was not going to testify. In fact, throughout the trial, if anything, it seemed more likely that he would testify. At the very end, when he determined that he would not testify and the court inadvertently omitted the instruction and even gave the parties multiple opportunities to review the instruction, the final instructions, even told the parties, speak now or forever hold your peace if you see any errors in it. The final instructions were 20 pages, just 20 pages, gave them an opportunity, and you can see this in the transcript, to review them. At that point in time, and perhaps it was inadvertence, the defense did not object. And even if it's inadvertent at that point, the best you can say is that when it really mattered, when the rubber hit the road, the defense did not view that instruction as so important that they were scrutinizing the 20-page jury instructions with time to see whether it was in there. So,
I mean, the government didn't notice either.
That's right. But we're not.
A lot easier. One of the two you would have noticed.
Of course. But on plain error, the burden is on the defense to demonstrate more than
the fact that, you know, neither side noticed. And again, I wasn't in the room. The district court was. The district court has a sense of the pace of the trial, what was going on in everybody's heads, what could have possibly led to this mistake. The district court, I mean, we had three people here who didn't notice. Right. This error, so it's a little hard to say. I mean, obviously, it's first and foremost on the defense, but
right. And the legal, it is a legal question. So this court does apply de novo review to the prejudice prong and plain error. And I note that although the district court
best case for that,
Arucci, that the reasonable probability of a different outcome. Admittedly, that was Brady materiality, but it's substantially the same standard. It's a legal question that this court reviews de novo, and a district court, by definition, abuses.
Anybody would find any cases from, it's not all that often that it's the district court applying plain error in the first instance.
That's right, so, but that.
I mean, if it's de novo, but surely we have to take into account in the district court's unique capacity to evaluate prejudice, much from the live case, much easier than we can from a cold record. So how would that factor into your de novo review standard?
Well, I think as Your Honor said, the district court just doesn't apply plain error that much. Who applies plain error frequently? This court. Nobody applies.
No, but I understand, yeah. But we've also been quite clear that the district court has a front row seat, has a capacity to evaluate the impact of evidence, the course of the litigation, the course of the trial. If you were on the other side, you'd be arguing exactly this point. And that district court has the expert view, and that has to count for something in this analysis. You're saying that it plays no role whatsoever in our de novo review.
Well, as I mean, that's sort of the nature of de novo review, that it's a
well, that's
it's
why
a
I'm
fresh
questioning your right. De novo review.
Right. It may be in a case in which
materiality is a legal concept. And Brady, what we're asking here, though, is there's not a legal error here, a fundamental legal error. I know you've argued about burden proof and stuff, but really we're just evaluating the district court's decision here, whether it's substantiated. And, you know, I don't know if there's many cases, if at all, where we reverse a district court just on the grounds that it misweighed the impact of an instructional error on the jury in light of the evidence of the case in the case.
I think that this court generally reviews the prejudice requirements. Brady and Strickland are the more are the sort of more frequent examples, mm-hmm. in which this court takes a de novo review of whether there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome, which is the same standard that is applied to the district court's authority to correct an unpreserved error under Rule 52B.
Who's better at evaluating what the implications of the split verdict were in this case, us or the district court?
I think in this case, in which it's a largely documentary case, it's not that this is based on the evaluation of the credibility of witnesses. Documents, they're all in front of both courts and evaluating what possible inferences could be raised by those. I don't think the district court is not in a better position than this court. What is more, when it comes to plain error, again, as Your Honor pointed out earlier,
that's a position the U.S. government wants to commit itself to in cases going forward as well, where you're on the other side of the, or you're the appellee, that the district court has no better capacity to evaluate the ebb and flow of the trial and the course of evidentiary submissions, the closeness of a jury verdict and how it may have worked itself out. That's the government's position. No deference whatsoever to the district court. I just want to make sure that's the U.S. government's position.
With respectfully, Your Honor, I think the question before the court is narrower.
No, you just made an argument about legal standard of de novo review that I understood, and tell me if I'm wrong, to be zero deference to the district court's front row seat and ability to evaluate the evidence and to understand the implications of error within the course of the trial because of that expert view. And you said, no, it's just de novo review, no deference to the district court. I'm trying to make sure that's the United States government's position. That's a legal position. That would not be just this case. That's going to be in every case going forward, even when the district court has come out on the top side of the district court's analysis. Is that the position of the U.S. government?
Right, that there's de novo review to the third prong.
No deference whatsoever to the district court's ability to make judgments about the impact of error on the trial.
I'm sorry if I'm not interested, but we've taken a position here, Your Honor, which is that
I'm trying to make sure I understand what that
sure,
position is, because
sure,
you said we think it's de novo review, and I said, well, how does the district court's expert view factor in? Is your position, yes or no, zero deference to the district court's analysis in consideration of the evidence and the ebb and flow of the trial and up front row seat to?
I don't think it's a binary, Your Honor. I think it's
What de novo review is, and I
right,
ask
that
you,
is,
what is the role for the district
right,
court's expertise?
Right.
And I was hearing none from
right,
you, but if there's
right,
a role, let me know.
Right. I don't think it is a binary in the sense that de novo review means this court takes a fresh look and exercises independent judgment. The court, of course, can give the district court's views and its ruling as much weight as it deserves. And it may be, in certain cases, it may be entitled to a great deal of weight. But in this case, in which the court did painstakingly lay out its reasoning, and its reasoning was flawed because it was based on the mere possibility of prejudice, the mere possibility that the jury held and drew an inference based on the defendant's decision not to testify when there was no suggestion whatsoever made in this case that it should do so. This is not that case where the district court's reasoning is entitled to that type of weight.
And then go to structural error versus us looking at this under Rule 52B. What position are you taking? Do you want us to go to the Carter analysis for a structural error, or do we just go under 52B and not need to reach that?
Well, Carter error is not structural error. It's regular constitutional trial error. I think the clearest indication of that is the fact that Griffin, error under Griffin v. California, which is can be a judge's direct comment on in its instructions on a defendant's decision not to testify, is not structural error. That's Chapman v. California. And the Carter instruction is kind of a prophylactic instruction for Griffin's prophylactic instruction. So it just stands to reason in logic that Carter error is not structural. I'd note too that, as we addressed in our reply brief, I can just point this point briefly, Rule 52B applies to structural errors as well, but Carter error is not structural here. It's ordinary trial error. There's no need to reach that point. So I see I'm well out of time. We would ask this court to reverse the new trial.
Thank you so much. We'll give you your 2 minutes to rebut.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, A.J. Kramer on behalf of Mr. Adams. Your Honors, the government has argued this case as if you're applying plain error to the situation, but the district court already did that. And all you're reviewing is for abuse of discretion of that. And the government has not pointed out any abuse of discretion on the district court. It's claimed that the district court applied the wrong standard is simply false. The last thing the district court said, one of the last things the district court said, had the court given the instruction, there is a reasonable probability that the jury would have been less willing to take the inferential steps required to convict Leaps and would have acquitted the defendant. That is exactly the correct test on error, like plain error like this on prejudice. The district court then went on the fourth prong to say the parties both requested the adverse instruction. The government says not quite correct that the defendant was requesting that. Again, that is simply false. The district court said that both parties requested the adverse instruction and the court agreed. The court and the parties discussed the instruction after defense counsel advised the court that the defendant would not testify. And then the court accidentally omitted the instruction. It did not catch its error and neither did the parties. The district court then previously, prior to that, reviewed in great detail the evidence in the case, the law, and how to apply the facts to the law. Let me just, in the Baptiste case, which I cited in length in the brief, the court talked about the importance of the district court having sat through the trial. This was a two-week trial, the district court. But this court in Catala said the same thing at page 641 to 642. We owe deference to the district court's assessment of a statement's prejudicial impact on the jury. Judge Cooper was present for the entire trial and could see how the jury reacted to the remarks. In Catala, the court went on to say, we have to accord due weight to the district court's on-the-ground judgment. And yet the government asks you to ignore the district court's judgment and asks you to ignore the statements in Catala.
Should the third prong of, or as we review the district court's application of the third prong of plain error, should our review be de novo, abuse of discretion? On one hand, it's kind of like a materiality standard. On the other hand, we've talked about the district court's expert capacity to evaluate the evidence and the impact of error on the jury. And so I'm not sure. It feels like it needs to be some sort of hybrid de novo.
I understand. And there is no case that stands for that it should be de novo review.
It's a piece of discretion that I could find either. So I'm trying to figure this out.
I think, first of all, it's a rare case where the district court engaged in de novo review. That's one issue, I think. And that's why you rarely see the standard on for the third prong of being how you review the district court's decision. But Arruche, on which the government tends to solely rely, says something that's almost just the opposite. He said, the question we're reviewing is not whether the district court properly exercised its discretion, but whether the court properly found a Brady violation. So in Arruche, there was a legal issue first. Was there even a Brady violation? This case, clearly there was a constitutional violation by, failing to give the instruction. So that part of the case was out, whereas Arruche specifically said, this distinction makes a Brady ruling different from other new trial rulings, because whether the government has breached its obligations under Brady is a question of law. That's at page 596 of Arruche. And they had previously said gone through what a Brady violation is. So they specifically distinguished a case where there's a Brady violation being a plain error from a new trial motion where it's reviewed for abuse of discretion. Other than that, I don't think there's any authority for reviewing the third prong. If in the rare situation where the district court has already decided that, for reviewing that de novo. It's a factual finding. The district court went through the record and as best it could, then Judge Kavanaugh said in Inouye, it's all somewhat of a speculative exercise, but the district court in this case went through the facts at great length, as in the Baptiste case, and reviewed them with respect to how it affected the jury. And the Supreme Court has been much more definitive about the instruction on a defendant's failure to testify. The government relied upon Griffin, but in the Carter versus Kentucky case in footnote 17, the court adopted the view that more harm may flow from the lack of guidance to the jury on the meaning of the Fifth Amendment privilege than from reasonable comment upon the exercise. In other words, they said a Carter or a Bruno or whatever you want to call it, the no adverse inference instruction is worse than the comment in Griffin versus California. It's more of a violation and more harmful to a defendant. So the Supreme Court in Carter took a view. And again, that clearly, it's not, it calls for almost speculation, because what they said is the jury will speculate. When the jury is left to roam at large with only its untutored instincts to guide it, to draw from the defendant's silence broad inferences of guilt. And that's what Judge Maeda had to deal with. And he very reasonably found that that there was a reasonable probability that the jury would have acquitted. With respect to the split verdict, that even more so, I think, shows the district court was correct. You can view a split verdict one of two ways. You can view it that maybe with that the jury did go through the evidence in particular. But the problem is, and especially when the Supreme Court has talked about the importance of this instruction, you can also view it in a much more direct way, that the jury acquitted, the evidence was so weak on the first count that the jury acquitted Mr. Adams. And yes, it was stronger on the second two counts. But if that instruction had been given, as Judge Maeda found, there was a reasonable probability they would have acquitted on that too. You can view the lack of unanimity both ways. And in this case, Judge Maeda went through the evidence in great specificity to show why that there was a reasonable probability that the jury would have acquitted. So
what do we do in reviewing plain error, not harmless error, with the other instructions that were given to the jury, including that Adams did not have to prove his innocence at all or produce any evidence at all? I get that it's not, those other instructions are not a sufficient substitute up front if a defendant asks for the instructions. So that's well settled. But in analyzing the plain error prong, prejudice prong, or maybe even the fourth prong, the integrity of the proceedings, do we look at all at what the other instructions covered?
Well, if the Supreme Court, I mean, I don't want to repeat what Your Honor just said, but the Supreme Court has been quite clear that instruction on the presumption of innocence on the jury needs to follow the evidence. None of that is a substitute for this instruction.
No, so there's error. There's error not to giving it. I'm stipulating that. But now it, in evaluating the consequences of that, I think the Supreme Court was saying there, no, you got to do it. It'll be error not to do it. You can't just say I did these other things. But given that we have error here, unfortunately, does that not temper the prejudice?
No, because that what they said was that those instructions don't ameliorate the error in any respect. That error is still there. It's not been ameliorated at all by the other instructions. They could not have been clearer, I think. And they could not, although the jury was instructed, it may be doubted that this instruction contributed in a significant way. I mean, they're quite clear about that doesn't make up for it. So I don't see how, just because it's in plain error, that the error is still just as plain, just as prejudicial, according to the district court. And the fact these other instructions played no role in any kind of lessening of that prejudice. So I don't see how that. And by the way, the government could have rendered this whole thing moot by object. They had the exact same opportunity to point out to the district court that the instruction had been inadvertently admitted. And if they had done that, we wouldn't even be here arguing this. It would have either been this issue. He would have either been acquitted or convicted. But this issue would not be before you if the government had just stood up and told the district court judge that the instruction had been omitted in the various translations of it going back and forth with the parties. So the notion that Mr. Adams' lawyer played any role in this is just not correct. And it was, first of all, it was never raised in the district court. It was raised in the first time on appeal, as the government admits in its brief. And second of all, the district court found just the opposite, that it was inadvertent on all parties.
I take the district court did not find it here, but if the district court did think it was gamesmanship, but otherwise everything's the same, how would that factor in? Would it go into the fourth prong then?
I think it would go to the fourth prong. I don't see how it would go to prejudice, perhaps a different result. And by the way, I think a different result is one juror. A hung jury is a different result than a convicting jury, but as an aside, as a direct argument, but hadn't been mentioned. But I think it would go to the integrity, fairness. It certainly seems to me that it could have impacted the fairness prong if a lawyer purposely doesn't object. But by the way, the Supreme Court addressed that scenario in Rosales-Morales, 585 U.S. at 144-45. It said, it is hard to imagine the defense counsel would deliberately forego objection now to a plain error that would subject her client to a higher guidelines range than was guidelines because counsel perceives some slightly expanded chance to argue for plain error. I mean, a lawyer is not going to sit there and let this instruction not be given when they've asked for it numerous times on the hope that on appeal that they'll prevail on plain error, that the instruction was not a much higher standard, whereas if they all they had to do was object to the district court and the it would have been given, just like if the government had pointed out to the district court, the instruction would have been given. So I think it would have, if there was gamesmanship, which was not in this case, and it was never raised in the district court, and the defense lawyer was not given a chance to respond to any such claim. But if it was, I could see that the court, as it did in the Gaines case, that it could be a different circuit, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which one, but that it could affect the whole fairness, the fourth prong. I could see that argument being made. I'm not going to argue it, but I do think the structural error argument is proper, but I think the court can decide it on the much easier ground of affirming that the district court did not abuse its discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Habel, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. So just to be brief and respond to a few points that Mr. Kramer made. First, the standard is not a reasonable probability that one juror would have hung the jury. The standard from Greer v. United States, the Supreme Court case, is a reasonable probability that the jury would have acquitted the defendant on plain error review. That's the standard. With respect to deference to the district court here, Mr. Kramer pointed out this was a 2-week trial. I'm not sure that was correct. It was essentially 3 or 4 days of testimony, most of it documentary. This is not a lengthy case.
I think he was referring to the case he was quoting.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I think the 2 weeks was referring to another case, the one he was quoting, not this case.
Oh, I'm sorry if I was confused, but certainly this case was not 2 weeks. It was several days of testimony. With respect to abuse of discretion versus de novo review of plain error and how that cashes out, you know, Rucci is clear that it may not make so much of a difference because a district court abuses its discretion by definition when it makes an error of law. Here, the district court made an error of law by misapplying in multiple ways the prejudice prong of plain error. And so in this case, whether it cashes out as...
was quite explicit that it was applying the reasonable probability standard.
It did, but as we've noted, that does not insulate its actual reasoning and some multiple legal errors it made, such as holding the government or holding, I guess, the government to a higher burden because the error was constitutional in nature. That's a hallmark of harmless error review, not a plain error. Plain error review, ordinary plain error review for constitutional errors.
The district court can't factor in the constitutional magnitude of the error at all in its plain error analysis?
That would go to prong four, Your Honor, that at that point, but even a prong four, serious constitutional error doesn't axiomatically suggest that.
No one thinks the district court did anything axiomatically here. It was clearly all the relevant circumstances analysis.
Right.
Sorry, I know your time's almost up. I didn't know if you had any quick thoughts on the structural error point or you resting on the brief as is the defendant.
My understanding from Mr. Kramer was he was not arguing that further, so I did not intend to. Okay, so we would ask this court to reverse the new trial grant. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you so much, counsel. The case is submitted.